Hello and welcome to Rules-Based Audio, a Lowy Institute podcast. In this series, we're exploring the rules-based order, a concept that's ever more prominent in debates about how the world works and how it should work. My name is Sasha Fegan. I'm a research associate on the Australia's Security and the Rules-Based Order project here at the Lowy Institute. In this episode, we'll be looking at online manipulation. Disinformation, misinformation, inauthentic behaviour, we know it's proliferating, we know it has a corrosive impact on trust and democratic institutions, but what can be done? Is the solution technical? Is it educational? Is it legal? And if so, is it best tackled country by country or through a multinational framework? My guest in this episode is Carl Miller. Carl is the Research Director at the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at the UK think tank Demos. He's also the author of Death of the Gods, The New Global Power Grab, which explores the impact of the digital revolution on global institutions and individuals. Carl, welcome.
Hi there, Sasha. Hi there, everyone.
Carl, before we get onto solutions, let's get a sense of what the current challenges are. The biggest information operation of the year has undoubtedly been the social media campaign around the Russian invasion of Ukraine. In the West, we've seen a lot of commentary about Ukraine winning the information war, but you are amongst a growing group of people who are ringing alarm bells about that. What have we been missing?
That's right. I mean, there was a whole flood of headlines, rather triumphant ones, kind of from March onwards, kind of all alleging in one way or another that kind of Putin's kind of propagandists were kind of caught flat-footed by the invasion. And, you know, it was quite understandable, Sasha. If your feed was anything like mine, you know, from that point to this, I mean, it's unrelenting, unbroken kind of sympathy for Ukraine. But when you actually dig under the surface, you begin to realise that there are contested information spaces all over the place that Western journalists and researchers just simply weren't exposed to, that weren't seeing. So to cut a very long story short, we analysed one of the first kind of really quite obvious pro-invasion information operations. It was targeting Twitter, and essentially in early March, it was to make two pro-invasion hashtags trend. They did trend. They trended around the world. I stand with Putin. I stand with Russia. They were picked up by mainstream media, written up, and there was mounting evidence in the days of that campaign and the days after that they were inauthentic, or at least partly inauthentic in some way or another. You know, there was lots of patterns which kind of implied there were. Our research basically tried to dig into the nature of the accounts that were really pumping the hashtag. Lots of maths involved, lots of machine learning. We essentially were using, I get very excited by new social media research methods. I might be the only person kind of listening to this or speaking that does, but I love them. I've spent my life working on them. And there's a whole generation of new model which we can use that creates much more general understandings of language. So we dumped lots of the messages each of these accounts sent into those models. We turned that into space and we mapped it. We realized, and then we, when it all got back, there were really dense clusters of these accounts that were really similar in the way they used language and really different from everywhere else. When you looked and characterized those clusters, they weren't what we normally see. I've almost always seen pulling apart pro-Russian information operations in the past. You normally see Make America Great Again accounts and BLM accounts, and basically accounts represent the kind of gamut of political polarization afflicting Western countries, but not this time. This time there was a Hindi language BJP cluster. There was a cluster from South Africa, one South Africa, Nigeria. There was a Tamil cluster from Tamil Nadu state in India. There was another cluster that kind of used Farsi and Sindhi. It was Pakistan-Iranian accounts. And basically, in a nutshell, this campaign wasn't either addressing nor pretending to be the West. There was lots of stuff about the West, Western hypocrisy, colonialism. It was essentially trying to recast the invasion as an anti-colonial gesture, really. I mean, however mad that sounds to our ears. But that was a kind of wake-up call to us that essentially Russian influence operations had kind of pivoted away from trying to exploit Western polarization and more actually now towards kind of global South, especially BRICS countries, that I think whoever was doing these campaigns kind of had considered more in play and persuadable and trying to basically detach those societies from what they were really seeking to characterise as a Western, not a global condemnation of the invasion.
So Russia's excelling at the manipulation of public opinion outside its borders, but here in Australia, we're often much more concerned with China's capabilities. How do you compare China's current capabilities with those of Russia? What are its strengths and weaknesses?
I mean, I think if anything, I mean, if you take information operations and manoeuvre in the information space, I mean, it really is important, by the way, I think, that we understand that information is considered by these states to be a theatre of war, literally a theatre of war, up there with air, sea, land and space, you know, and they're manoeuvring in it as they would manoeuvre in any of those other spaces. If we kind of extrapolate kind of China's kind of technological capabilities into that arena, I mean, we should expect them, and I think they are far more capable than Russia. Russia has kind of danced this kind of pannish, kind of postmodern, kind of gleeful kind of trying to destroy and exploit Western opennesses. I think China, like Russia, has become far more concerned in recent years with kind of international perceptions of itself, but is building a far more ambitious machinery around all of that. I mean, we're seeing kind of enormous amounts of, say, activity by Chinese state diplomatic accounts. We have a report coming out on that. We've been busy monitoring roughly within a week's time now. So I think in many ways they're not simply just trying to kind of conduct spoiling tactics against the West. They are actually trying to construct an entirely alternative kind of, sorry for using a researcher word here, kind of epistemological space, an entirely different machinery for creating, validating, justifying the truth.
And is that, like Russian online manipulation, is that mainly aimed at non-Western countries then, or is that also aimed inside Western countries? And I'm asking that because, I mean, what are the limitations of how far Western or liberal democracies can go to actually prevent or curtail the spread of that manipulation?
Yeah, so when I'm talking about Chinese influence operations here, I'm talking my window into them is in a much more general sense than simply pro-invasion messaging. I mean, China talks about lots of things all the time to lots of watching audiences, you know, pandas are extremely popular within Chinese messaging, but what we have seen and kind of the main argument that the paper we're about to release is going to make is that there's very strong variations in its messaging and in its activities according to what region of the world you look at. So in Eurasia, for instance, and in say the Indo-Pacific, a lot more to do with kind of geopolitical issues, a lot more about calling out the West on a whole series of kind of issues to do with human rights and geopolitics. Towards the West, much softer. Towards Europe and in the Americas, it's a lot more to do with Chinese culture, Chinese language. Confucius Institutes are more active. It's a lot of a kind of soft, much more of a kind of soft power lens on China, much less desire really actually to talk either about human rights, and all the controversies raging in China, and globally, which interact with human rights, nor really much about as much at least about geopolitics. So yeah, I mean, I think they're tailoring, and it will become more intricately tailored in the years ahead. Their message much more to do with audience than what we've seen actually so far. With Russia.
Carl, I've read a lot of reports on influence operations over the years, and I'm still stunned at how many conclude with just two main policy recommendations. One is that we need better regulation of big tech. In other words, we need more platform regulation. In the US, that tends towards encouraging self-regulation by the platforms, whereas in the EU, the tendency is towards externally imposed regulations. The other recommendation is that we need population-wide programs teaching people digital literacy. The idea is teach it to school kids, teach people how to spot fake news, how to spot misinformation. Are those things enough? And if not, why not?
No, they're not. They're not even remotely enough. In many ways, I think we, you know, our thinking around responding to these kinds of information threats have ossified tremendously. And we badly need new ideas, actually, and to radically widen the array of the things that we can do to essentially levy costs and risks against the people that do it. Now, where to begin? I mean, I, I think the starting point actually is that digital calls for digital literacy, which, by the way, I mean, I was making at Demos 10 years ago, so it's not like I'm against the idea of digital literacy, but there's very little, I think, evidence to suggest it's actually going to work in this against this particular problem. The starting point is that disinformation is really not the best way of understanding this problem at all. Disinformation is just one of a whole array of different tactics that are part of this tradecraft. This is information warfare, information maneuver. We don't have a particularly consensual vocab yet around what actually to call this. But when you actually pull apart these campaigns, the first thing you realize is that, you know, this isn't really mostly interacting at the level of like rational truth claims. We have this very rigid rationalist conception of what these campaigns are doing. That, I mean, I've interviewed some of the people that actually do these campaigns over the years. And the one message time and again that I hear back from them is they say, Carl, we don't lie about the world to get people to change their mind. We tell people things they already think are true about the world and try and harness that in certain directions. And that was the case. The Russian influence operation was a brilliant example of that. I mean, these were pro-invasion memetics that were hooking into already standing, you know, angers and resentments very rightly around the world around, you know, Western colonialism. You know, and then to harness that in a certain direction by trying to connect that with therefore anti-war sentiment. A lot of influence operations really actually act at the level of emotion or feeling, belonging, you know, sense of right and wrong in the world, outrage, as much as they do about kind of a rational claim. So I often think that the kind of, you know, digital literacy skills, as far as we try and teach people to, like, you know, check your sources and you know make sure that you triangulate, you know, where you're getting different, you know, kind of evidence to support a truth claim for, and different hierarchies of evidence. So, like, this completely misses the point. I mean, what we're up against here is kind of, you know, Putin, you know, riding bear memes, you know, and anti-NATO memetics. We're not confronting necessarily just disinformation. So also, this is a tradecraft which is being, you know, in part conducted by professional, you know, influence operators, you know, and in part by a kind of for-profit, you know, rapidly innovating space. I don't think we can have any expectation that we can, like, upskill an entire population basically in counterintelligence, counter-influence tradecraft of its own. You know, how on earth are we supposed to reach anyone outside of formal education? You know, how on earth are we supposed to re-educate people on the changing techniques every year? It's a warm, fuzzy response, which the tech giants love because it doesn't therefore pose any questions about how their platforms work. Governments and others love it because it doesn't pose any hard questions to do with, you know, rebalancing any of the kind of basic responsibilities of government or the relationships between individuals and the state or anything like that. It just isn't going to be successful. And actually, I've over the years kind of increasingly seen it actually as being actively a bit unhelpful because it's unhelpful in the way that it actually makes people feel like we're doing something against this problem, spending a couple of million here and there when really I actually don't think it's doing much at all. And platform regulation, likewise. You know, we've spent 10 years kind of asking the platforms to kind of respond to this. And, you know, drag them slowly but surely into a kind of more responsive posture. My big problem actually with all of that is that it doesn't actually really protect the information spaces, which I think are most at risk. I mean, we've massively over-focused as researchers and as journalists on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter because it's really researchable and Facebook because it's really big. You know, and actually that misses out on so many different information spaces which can be targeted by information warfare. I mean, we've got a report coming out on Wikipedia.
I just want to go back to, I know one issue you're really interested in is corporatization of influence for hire. And I'm just wondering to what extent you think that that is the biggest emerging trend that we're going to see. And then following that, where the role of law steps in then to perhaps regulate that emerging industry, particularly in liberal democracies, say the UK and Australia. What's the potential role there for sort of regulating those PR firms?
Disinformation or influence operations, you know, on demand for profit have always been kind of part of this scene. I've seen that as in a strange way, kind of echoing the kind of private intelligence industry which has emerged. You know, it's kind of probably a statecraft which was first developed by states, and then people leave and they kind of set up their own kind of like for-profit shops and sometimes sell those self-same services back to governments. But I think a big that one of the most important trends over the last couple of years has been how rapidly that has grown. And actually, where it began probably more as a kind of software sales and the kind of selling the raw materials, you know, like bundles, you know, thousands of fake accounts. Like, I think what we're seeing now is the kind of emergence of kind of service models for this, you know, yeah. So dodgy PR firms, both on Lightnet and truly into the kind of criminal markets as well. That's one of the big trends. It's up there with this going more local, the barriers to entry ever more decreasing, partly thanks to that industry operating. I think a more higher stakes, higher value information being targeted. Those are, I think, the three trends. But yes, you know, much of this isn't illegal, or at least there is no case law around it. So that means that you have fairly substantial companies with fairly large liabilities basically openly offering kind of influence operation services, which I think societies would broadly agree shouldn't be a legitimate offering. You know, it shouldn't be a kind of fair commodity to Google bomb your competitors so that you can scrub them off the front page of a search, or so you can manipulate all of your online real estate so that it floats up. This, you know, and it definitely shouldn't be legitimate that you set up thousands of accounts to make stuff trend during a political campaign. These are forms of lying. Right now, you know, I think the law is probably really one of the major kind of areas that we should extend into our response kind of repertoire. You know, I'm no lawyer. I'm sure that lots of people listen to this that far more educated and learned in the law than I. But it seems, at least from my extremely lay eyes, that there's everything from kind of defamation law through and libel law through to consumer rights legislation and indeed criminal law as well, that we might actually bring to bear to really start increasing the liabilities for this kind of thing to occur. You know, if you look, for instance, at say the defamation action taken against Alex Jones by the Sandy Hook families, you know, that is a great example of basically like an online harm, you know, that swam with all of the different kind of forces which makes conspiracy, you know, makes responding to this so difficult. Really clickbaity conspiracy theory, like, you know, kind of played with all the algorithms of all the major platforms, tons of visibility. But eventually it was the law really that reined those claims in. And we should try and learn from that and see what we can do to extend that to these new problems as well.
Okay, so that's a potential legal solution. But another solution that people get really excited about are the technological solutions to online manipulation. And there are plenty of companies also springing up who have proposing artificial intelligence algorithms to spot and take down disinformation. What's the potential of those products, and is there a technical fix for this?
Yeah, I'm going to sound so grumpy, I think, during this whole podcast, actually, because I view that really much of that quite dimly as well. Let me take a second to explain this. So again, firstly, like, trying to spot disinformation, as in people lying on the internet, is not the solution that we need to be reaching for. Like, basically, that's kind of like trying to spot the technique of snooping on a street corner, rather than saying there's a series of named sophisticated bad actors that will seek to interfere in our election, and those actors, whatever tradecraft they try and use, are what we need to stop. Like, that's how counterintelligence works, and that's how our counter-influence should work, whether it's civil society or government. But there are lots of companies that are springing up with these, you know, models which essentially are kind of software as a service models where machine learning aided kind of detection, usually via APIs, they seek to kind of offer to detect this kind of thing. I have a tech company with colleagues that works on natural language processing all day, every day. I mean, we've done natural language processing for so long, and it is in and of itself, like, there is no universe. I truly believe that you cannot build some kind of universal, secret, proprietary, magical algorithm to try and detect this kind of thing. The language varies so much from one context to another. It changes from one time to another. It's really difficult to find this kind of stuff anyway. The only way, the only method that I've ever really managed to discover, which or use, which is capable of kind of unearthing, exposing, trying to trying to attribute and so on these kinds of campaigns, is a Supermix team, reactive technology development, very agile technology, you know, ranging all the way from technologists and tool developers down to data scientists, data journalists, down to open source intelligence investigators and thematic specialists and linguists, you know, and you try and mix that team up, and they have one function, which is like to continuously scan the arena, trying to find this kind of stuff. And that's actually where machine learning is most helpful. And then another one where they're really pulling these campaigns apart. I would say one final thing on this is that I think that one of the reasons these kinds of offerings are being made around the kind of magical algorithm is actually because of the way in which venture capitalism works. So venture capitalists love that kind of model. You know, software as a service, really, really scalable. You know, so you can, if you crack it using machine learning, then it can suddenly, you've got this company which can kind of 50x within a year. Actually, you know, when you actually look at the white papers that many of these companies produce, you know, they're actually just good old fashioned open source intelligence white papers, you know, because that's really what works. You know, it's kind of tracking the activities of individual, and suspicious accounts, which I think is often great work. You know, the people that work in those companies like are truly trying to solve the problem. It's like they're kind of hampered by what they're having to tell venture capitalists in terms of how their companies work, though. So you get these ridiculous situations where you've got human, like good shoe leather, like human data journalism being masquerading as some kind of automated solution. That's the problem.
Carl, you'd be familiar with the work of Thomas Ridd, the disinformation scholar from Johns Hopkins University, whose book Active Measures has become a kind of go-to text on disinformation. He argues that it's impossible to excel at disinformation and democracy at the same time. In other words, he's talking about the idea that if liberal democracies, the militaries of liberal democracies, get into the offensive information warfare game, a kind of moral rot will set into our body politic. What do you think? Is it inevitable that militaries of liberal democracies will get into this space?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there is a kind of increasing, what's the right words here? Frustration from the military leaders in liberal democracies, that they see that theatre is extremely dynamic, but it's also the one where they've got the least, I think, in their eyes, permission to operate. No one's published any rules of engagement in the information sphere, right? So I think, you know, in many ways, like the actual conducting of influence operations is technically extremely trivial for a military. You know, this isn't rocket science. It's really not, compared to like, you know, building an F-22 Raptor or something. I mean, this is so simple to do. So I often think it really isn't technical feasibility, it's legal permissibility that is holding liberal democracies back. And rightly so, because I do agree with Thomas there. I think for all of us who are like writers or researchers or you know, anyone who enjoys kind of culture or the kind of intellectual output of societies, you know, we have to think that information has kind of intrinsic value in and of itself. It's one of the things that actually makes societies worthwhile. And that is the one thing that information warfare drains out of information. So information, whilst central to the idea of information warfare, actually is only useful insofar as it has an ulterior impact, you know, whether it basically causes attitudinal or behavioural change. Because that's ultimately what information warfare, information manoeuvre is trying to do. So, in that model, kind of any information which manages to affect that or manages to create the right effects is fine. It's therefore purely instrumentalized. So I agree. I think the more that we militarize information, the more we instrumentalize it, the more we drain it from any of this kind of precious kind of cultural intellectual value that it has. And actually, the more in the long term, we'll drain trust and faith and goodwill out of people's engagement with information. And that's always been our strengths, right, as liberal democracies, you know, as free, open, strong journalism and amazing scientific, you know, strengths and all the rest of it. We thrive. We need information to be more than simply a tool we use to change each other's behavior. So I agree. I think that's right. And I think we need to find ways of basically levying kind of asymmetric responses. You know, we've got a lot of other strengths, be that economic, military, cyber offensive operations, and so on, the law. Those are the things we need to use to basically start to deter information maneuver.
Carl, probably the biggest story in internet freedom and internet politics this year is Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter. I don't want to do too much of a segue into this, but I just want to get down to that notion of freedom of speech on Twitter. Musk calls himself a free speech absolutist, and notoriously he wants President Trump's lifetime Twitter ban lifted. Do you see any larger implications of Elon Musk's Twitter purchase, or is this kind of a first world problem?
Firstly, like, it's ridiculous that we have to care what Elon Musk or any of these distant billionaires actually think about the platforms. I mean, the whole point should be, and hopefully will be, that we put these platforms under proper democratic control and oversight. That's the point of the Online Harm Bill, and that will be the point of more democratic legislation coming through. This position that Musk is striking is just showing a kind of ignorance of where the online harms movement came from. I mean, we came from a place where, in 2015 and 2016, YouTube's algorithms were pouring unprecedented millions of eyeballs into the hands of the far right and the alt-right online. You know, we're coming from a place where, extremist political mobilizations were wantonly manipulating platforms, both trending creation, search engines, and so on, in order to, get their message out in ways which are entirely unfair, and where that kind of message, the conspiracy theorist message was beating out kind of conventional messaging, not because it was true or because it was winning the argument, but because it was better able to travel in online spaces and was keeping people more hooked on the platforms where it was being shared. All of that was basically beginning to make was making the point again and again that the online harm movement was fighting for a fair playing field for all ideas to have equal footing. It wasn't trying to make liberal centrist ideas more visible. It was reacting against the idea that they were being deliberately less visible in online spaces. So that's where all of this comes from. On top of that, like, honestly, the idea that you can be free speech absolutist at a time when we're having activists and journalists harassed, threatened, and kind of mobbed out of online spaces, I think is absolutely outrageous. Absolutely the preserve of white entitled billionaires from the West.
We've in the West concentrated a lot of our efforts and studies of online manipulation on Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. But you've been looking at Wikipedia recently. So, what are the big challenges there?
Thanks for the opportunity on this one, Sasha. Yeah. So, I mean, largely, I think we're trying to make two points of this paper. The first is really that Wikipedia is kind of quite overlooked as an information space. It's really valuable. It's really visible. It's a place which is highly trusted and that people go to really to kind of settle the debates that they might be having on Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere. And it's actually a place that the tech giants like Google actually lean on, to try and navigate their own way through this world of influence and disinformation. So it's really important and might well be being subject to more influence operations than we think. I mean, this stretches back to a BBC investigation I did several years ago now, where we were passed documents, one written by a PRC official and one by a PRC-linked academic, actually laying out a strategy from the Chinese government to systematically manipulate Wikipedia. So we part of the paper is kind of pointing out that we need more research being done, and it's kind of being overlooked. I think the other part, though, is trying to deploy some of the kind of techniques that we've built and we use on other platforms onto Wikipedia. It's a very small kind of limited scoping study that only looks at editors that have already been removed as a result of the policies of Wikipedia, but does notice that they act these removed editors have done a huge number of edits actually across the platform, and they sometimes act in quite concerted and coordinated ways, And when you look at the patterns, you can sometimes find other editors that, on the basis of their behaviour, look like they're linked to the ones that have been removed. So it's very initial, very preliminary. But basically, what we're trying to do is just start a conversation about whether these techniques can be more widely deployed alongside all the other things that Wikipedia has to try and defend the platform.
The social media space is rapidly evolving, and one of the new technological trends is blockchain-based social media platforms. So what particular challenges does that pose in terms of freedom, privacy, state control, and regulation of social media?
Yeah, so you have the decentralized social media platforms, both protocol based, so Mastodon, you know, and other decentralized ones like Twitter and so on. So, but then you also have actually, you know, entirely kind of blockchain based organizations, DAOs, you know, which kind of behave and act like companies, but with no legal impersonation, no articles of association, no, you know, nominated officials and so on. And kind of when you put all of that together, I think they probably pose like one enormous problem, really, for governments and the law, which is like, who do you pick up the phone to kind of either regulate, fine, or sue them? Like a company that essentially only exists as a complicated smart contract on a blockchain, how does that have exposure to our entire legal system? So if you're a state regulator, basically the whole of the regulatory system is based on the idea of kind of, you know, levying various kinds of kind of like penalties on legally impersonated organizations to create liabilities to change behavior. How does that work when you've got something which doesn't kind of, as far as I can see, legally exist? So that to me is probably from the kind of like this drives deepest at this basic question, which we've spent the last decade worrying about now, which is how do we kind of extend the kind of laws and rules and regulations and standards and norms that we've spent centuries developing, you know, to kind of civilize really power and money and wealth and all the rest of it onto the internet, as that evolves ever faster in ways which become more and more resilient and in many ways kind of hostile actually to the application of the law.
One final question. You're from the UK, obviously, and the UK has just very recently introduced this online safety bill. There's a lot yet to be worked out, but it looks at things like illegal material, duties to protect children, duties about fraudulent advertising, and identity verification rules. But what do you think it gets right? What do you think it gets wrong? And will it be successful?
Yeah, I think it's too early, really, to kind of answer almost all of that question, unfortunately, Sasha. I mean, it's trailblazing. It's a pioneering piece of legislation. This is unbelievably difficult. I don't want to, you know, I mean, I think lots of people can levy lots of criticisms of the online safety bill. But to be honest with you, I mean, it's trying to do what so much of civic society has been calling for so long, which is, you know, the creation of democratically accountable and constituted rules onto a space which has been far too freewheeling and far too lawless for far too long, you know. And so, in its attempt to do that, I'm full of applause and full of support for it. And I think it's fairly limited in what it's trying to do initially, you know, and basically is only holding companies up to their own rules and standards, really, by you know, which they try and govern their platforms with. But I think that's a start. And from that start, we can it will roll out and it will become more intricate and the definitions will change and expand probably too, and really become a kind of web of law and case law and convention around extending the law onto the internet and extending the kind of standards and expectations we have for public life and for private life onto the internet too. So we don't know how it's going to work. We don't know how it's going to be deployed. We don't know how it's going to be used yet. But insofar as it exists, it's I think a really, really, really good positive step in the right direction.
I will ask one more question, which is just what your thoughts are. So earlier this month, the US launched the Declaration for the Future of the Internet, which lays out priorities for an open, free, global interoperable, reliable, and secure internet. All the EU countries signed on, Japan, the UK, Australia signed on, but obviously the authoritarian states have not signed on. Do you see this as a kind of alternative to a kind of UN system of trying to regulate the internet? Is that what it's trying to be? What are your thoughts?
Well, so there's always been this kind of tension at the heart of internet governance between kind of a state-based model, which, and there is, there's the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU, which is a UN body, which has regulated various kinds of kind of internet-related questions in the past, including IoT. And the Internet Governance Forum, which I've been to one, and it's this kind of mad, colourful, hectic, energetic kind of meeting point for all the different tribes of the internet. You know, the activists and the technologists and the big tech companies and states, and I'm sure lots of spies as well. You know, but basically is a, at its heart, has multi-stakeholderism. The idea that no particular group should kind of capture, you know, and be able to dictate, you know, much, not least states, you know, how, what the internet really looks like. And there's always been a bit of a tension between those two things. And that declaration is very much a kind of recommitment for the West to the multi-stakeholder model. By the way, which I don't think has really been in doubt. I don't think there was really much question that the West, the Europe or the US was moving away from that. What I really think this is about is the splinter net, really. So, you know, and this was kind of 5 or 6 years ago, I think this was people were worried about. And now I think it's being spoken about in ways which really make it an inevitability. We're going to see global interoperability. I mean, we've already have seen global interoperability basically break down. I mean, you know, and this is essentially the kind of cleaving off of the Chinese internet first, you know, Russia in a sense is following. And there's very likely going to be the kind of rise of two kind of technospheres, to borrow the concept of an author I can't remember, but basically one technosphere, you know, which will be led by the US, and one technosphere which will be led by China, probably with ever decreasing interoperabilities between them.
Thanks so much, Carl. That was an absolutely fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Carl Miller is a research director at the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at UK think tank Demos. I'm Sasha Fegan. Thanks for joining me on the Lowy Institute's Rules-Based Audio podcast. This podcast is part of the Rules-Based Audio Project, which is supported by the Australian Department of Defence.